Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Deb Roberts, and I am the host for Season 2 of the Mind Medicine Australia's podcast. Before we begin with this week's guest, a reminder that Mind Medicine Australia's focus is on the development and the use of evidence-based psychedelic-assisted therapies within regulated healthcare systems. We do not, though, encourage the use of psychedelic medicines outside of this context, and we do not support the use of these substances in any way that is unlawful. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. None of the content herein constitutes medical advice. Guests' views are their own and do not represent the views of Mind Medicine Australia, and individuals need to discuss their individual healthcare needs with their healthcare providers. Thank you for listening. So welcome, Andrew Robb, to the Mind Medicine Australia podcast season 2. We are really grateful that you've taken the time to talk to us today. So thank you very much. Welcome.
That's my pleasure. Thanks, Deborah.
And before we go into hopefully what will be a enlightening, you know, conversation, a rich conversation, I start, and it's possibly more for me than anyone else, but maybe also any listeners and yourself, just to take about 30 seconds to ground. I often say my feet are usually without shoes on the ground. That's because of a busy head. And often that grounding mechanism is really just helpful to be able to talk about some of the topics we will be discussing in an authentic way. And so having a conversation, just starting with our own breath. So anyone that feels like can either close their eyes if they're not, in movement, but just taking a little bit of a moment just to kind of rid the whatever's been going on since today, since we have started, or what's maybe going to be in the future, and just allowing the breath to kind of connect with literally the way we are alive. As you're ready, letting the eyes flutter open. Sometimes there's a bit more clarity, a little film or a residue that releases. So I have a rather open question for you, Andrew, at the beginning. Before we go into, you know, some of your background, one of the questions I've been asking, purposefully open-ended, is could you just briefly share at the moment what you feel connected with in your life at present, if you're happy to share?
Well, that's probably involves quite a lot, but I mean, my primary connection I feel is with my family. My best friend would be my wife. Like most men, like many men, you don't have many close friends. Sadly, I think there's a group called Men's Table who I think are doing a fantastic job in that regard. But my grandchildren and children. So, you know, that's, I've got so many other things on my plate from a work position, which I enjoy. I've got things that are really stimulating me at the moment, and nation building projects, which is what I wanted to do post politics. And they're certainly things that, you know, I relate to and enthusiastic about. But in terms of being grounded, it's my family. Immediate family. I got a much broader family too. My mother, who's 95 and still alive, and my father just died a couple of years ago. And between them, there's 85 people on this earth that wouldn't be there if it hadn't have been for them if they didn't start with 9 children. So,
wow.
So there's plenty of others to do. That I relate to well, actually, but in terms of grounding, it's my immediate family. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you for being so honest with that. The I think you said there were 9 children, is that right? 9?
I'm one of 9, yes.
That's 9. I had read that, but it's nice to share with listeners who aren't as familiar with your background. I asked the question because, and this is repeated in the episodes, my sister, my only sister, ended her life a year ago, November 16th. So just after, I'm just 1 year on. And it's interesting. I resonate with the 9 siblings, and I know it's, 9 siblings. I'm sure it wasn't euphoria every moment. And I'm sure there's challenges, et cetera, as any social relationships and family relationships can be. But I asked the question quite deliberately in that open-ended way, because she didn't feel connected, obviously, at the end, people who end their lives, which sadly, is a statistic that isn't necessarily going down. It's, when there's a lack of connectivity. So I think that it's very reassuring to hear just different people that I'm talking to, share that. So I know it was purposely open-ended. So thank you.
I'll just reflect for a second on that, because when you have depression, I think you get deeply sad. I can get sad about anything when I'm in a depressed state, which is unfortunately every morning still. But you automatically, I don't know why it is, when you're depressed, any reference to you're so alert to any reference to suicide, and often you can't get it out of your mind. And hours later, when you're not depressed, which is my case, I got a sort of bipolar daily thing. I wouldn't think of it. It doesn't resonate. It doesn't stick. Yet it keeps popping up, and especially, when you hear about cases. And the thing is, and you do find yourself thinking about what would you do? Would you do it? And why not do it, et cetera? But it is, for me, the ground. I always think of the impact it would have on my immediate family. And it makes me think, there's no way I'm going to put them through that. No matter, I'll work through this again. But so it is very important, the question you've asked. Is a person, that could be anything, but it could be any sort of thing they're grounded with. But it's a constant reference point for me in terms of, moving on from those thoughts of actually doing something like taking your own life.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I, the opportunity to be internally connected. So the notion of, kind of knowing oneself, self-reflective, the relationship with oneself, as well as, and you clearly had said in terms of family, the social relationships we have, and being privileged if we are in families that have a lot of support and scaffolding around. You mentioned that and you were honest, and I appreciate that, about not having so many male friends that you can really show our true authentic self, as you said, your wife being your best friend. I think, how lucky in a way having those. And yet, as an example, she, like other people, had, she has 2 grown kids, wonderful husband, a lot of family. She married into a family of 14 children, of 14, her husband or her partner. So I share that because, you know, it's intrigued me ongoing of how much scaffolding you can have around and yet still, you know, be very extremely, I would say, unwell to be able to take those, you know, to make that choice. So I know that the notion of psychedelics, which we will communicate about in terms of, you know, treatment options and what is the potential of this, you know, this space in the industry. And I know you're very involved. I wondered, though, just as whatever you'd like to share, I know you said about the 9 children, just a little bit about your background for people who are overseas listening to this or are not as familiar with your sure. background.
I come from, in what we call in Australia, working class family, brought up on a dairy farm principally, and then in my teens, we moved to the city. I went off to study agricultural science and at an agricultural college, and then discovered economics. And when I'd finished the agricultural science, I then did a degree in economics, straight degree in economics at night, and worked as an animal health officer for a few years during the daytime. But then I'm agricultural economist in policy areas, primarily agricultural marketing, and in particular, then was approached to go to the National Farmers Federation, which represents all of Australia's farmers. And shortly, 3 years later, I was CEO of that organisation. That was the 80s, the 90s. I got approached to run the Liberal Party of Australia. The National Farmers Federation had been, I think, very successful in terms of running a lot of issues. And it was a time of big policy change, the 80s, 70s and 80s in Australia. It was very exciting if you're someone like an economist, with the floating of the dollar and freeing up of banking system, lots of things. Freeing up everything we were a highly regulated economy in the first 75 years of our time as a country. When we moved on from being a colony from 1901, the next 75 years deeply regulated in all sorts of areas of our endeavour, and the next 20 years was a time of huge change and much more than most of the rest of the world. And we've been the beneficiary because we've seen this unbelievable growth now for the last quarter of a century, all driven by that. And both sides of politics contributed heavily from Keating and Hawke in the first place, but with the support of John Howard from opposition. And then John Howard took over as Prime Minister and continued that reform process. And, you know, now we're all the beneficiary. And I travel the region still widely, and I can tell you we are the beneficiary of a lifestyle that is enjoyed by very few other countries, to be honest. And I've had the pleasure of that. I did ran all the political campaigns for the Liberal Party in the 90s. I went off then for trying to get a bit of work experience experience outside of politics. I had some really interesting projects for about 7 years. Working with Kieran James Packer and putting together a big data business long before big data was talked about, but it really was big data. And then I stood for Parliament. I was keen. I wanted to get some experience in the commercial world, but then I was keen to try and go into Parliament myself, not just be the General Secretary running all the campaigns. I did run John Howard's campaign in 96, which got him into the prime ministership with the biggest Liberal win in history. So that's something I'm still very proud of, because he did such what I think, and I think many Australians think, he did such an outstanding job. And that's why he's an elder statesman, respected, I think, by most people on both sides of politics, because he's a decent man, basically. And that's what I got more than anything else from him. the importance of being decent to everybody, respecting everybody, no matter who they are. And so I then went into the parliament. I had many different portfolios. We had all the ups and downs. We were in government, out of government. We lost government for 3 years after I got there. And I thought I made a bad call here. I was heading towards 60 and I didn't want to be in opposition. But fortunately, from my point of view, but I think at the time from Australia's point of view, as it turned out, we were 6 years and then regained office. And by that stage, I was in the cabinet and Minister for Trade and Investment. And I had the good fortune that was timing's important in this world. And but it was a time when a lot of the region were thinking about moving towards being more open than they'd ever been, and not so protectionist. So I did free trade. I negotiated a free trade agreement with South Korea. I negotiated Australia's free trade agreement with Japan. The big one was certainly negotiating China. We're still the only G20 country that's got such a deal with China. And you know, now it's led to tens of billions of dollars of trade since then, since 2015. And so that's certainly the sort of the next one on my list of things that I think I'm really proud of, to be honest, even though we've had some political problems and all the rest at a commercial level. It's very good. And the fact is that Chinese business people like doing business with Australian business people, and Australian business people like doing business with Chinese business. And I've studied it a lot, and I'm involved with a couple of companies that have got supplier relationships and things out of China. And the thing is, with the Chinese, they don't do a deal easily. But once you shake on it, that's it. And once you shake on it, they seem to have a capacity to make the rest of it happen too. The containers arrive when they say that. The customs work's done, paperwork's. And that's not true of lots of countries and of businesses in countries. You know, people do a deal and 4 days later you get a call to say, they want 10% more off or want some change in it or they're having second thoughts or whatever. And so there is, it's hard. There's some sort of, there's something going on there with the Chinese. And I've also seen it with the Vietnamese. A similar thing. There's some relationship, something in our psyche, which means that both the business people in both countries, but also I see it in the arts and lots of other areas where we have relationships. It's just that you can trust people in the end. And it takes a while, but once you do get to that point, once you can trust them, you can trust them. And now we differ in politics. On things, and that could ebb and flow, but at a commercial level, I think it's one of our really strong relationships, to be honest, because it kept improving even while at a political level things had turned to custard. At a commercial level, it kept improving, notwithstanding some barriers put in the way and some things that were blocked. We kept growing our trade, so that's been a big part of, and it's been interesting to see too, because once we had I was getting approached to do a lot of things and then the political side of it went south. And, if I said anything about the commercial relationship or said anything, I'd be accused of being a stooge for the Chinese. And it was... It's now the thing that, and I think to be fair to Albanese and to Penny Wong in particular, I think is on the Chinese policy side have done a great service to Australia, just to stabilise relationship. We're never going to agree with them on politics and them with us. So, but it is an issue partly of mutual respect, that you can disagree, and you can say you disagree, but it's how you say it, etc., rather than rubbing someone's nose in it, and you know, for actually often for other political purposes, I got to say, but I won't get into all that. But it's been an interesting few years in that regard to. You know, to go from being, you know, the leading architect. I had a lot of support from very talented staff and whatever, but to lead that process and then find when you want to reflect on maintaining the commercial side of it, you know, to be pilloried as a stooge, etc. So. Again, there's other motives there. I don't need to get it. We could have an hour on that, but that's been an important part of my last few years, I've got to say. But you know, now I'm, you know, after that trade and investment, I did some others. Did the Trans-Pacific Partnership there. You know, did a major part of the Indonesian relationship, the Indian relationship. I got to know Modi very well personally, which has been a great privilege. And you know, I've done all the ASEAN countries with agreements. So it's that whole trade investment, and probably much of what I'd done in earlier parts of my life without picking it out, it sort of set me up for that position. And I was lucky to land in a job where I had confidence about what I was doing and where I wanted to take it, right? And you know, sometimes it's for a lot of politicians, they get given a portfolio, which is great, but they start from sort of, you know, point zero. They might be an area they're not familiar with. And you know, you can't get on top of things quickly. And often they'll work their tail off, but it's very hard to sort of get to a commanding position in the position. Quickly. So I was really lucky in that regard to have the experience I'd had, which sort of, I felt like I'd spent 40 years getting ready for that job, to be honest. And so I hit the ground running and enjoyed it thoroughly. It was 200 nights overseas each year and then another 100 nights in Canberra. But I got a wife, you know, I've done, I think, in my business career, bear in mind, the National Farmers Federation, which is all over Australia, Liberal Party, all over Australia. Then politics, more generally, all over Australia, different portfolios. I figure I've done about 8,000 flights in my career. Obviously, most of them domestic until the last few years, but still now I'm at the overseas ones are adding up very quickly. But it's, you know, I really have been blessed with opportunities and interesting career, and I say this, you know, we'll get into it, but it's notwithstanding the fact that every day I started deeply depressed. So
yeah, I was reflecting.
You can do things. You can, well, you know, it just depends. Some people are really so sad for those who've got a problem 24/7. It's, oh, I can't imagine such a cross to bear. But, you know, I've had an issue since early in the morning, but I came out of it to be, you know, I started at couple of hours, and then it maybe got in my 40s and 50s a bit longer, but I turned into an A-type person, usually mid-morning. And so I've run organisations since I was 28.
How did you, just on that, I think you must have a very understanding wife.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you said about that close relationship that you have, best friend. I think that says a lot about you as well, for even articulating that, you know, early in the piece. And reflecting, you know, there's so many people, I mean, I'm included myself in that have
challenges mentally, and even with what could be called blessed lives, and many people don't have blessed lives, let's face it, that the daily effort, well, daily sadness, daily, you know, where the mind loops, and not necessarily able to thrive in that space when they're experiencing that. And, you know, of it with my sister as an example, you know, I shared at the beginning, you know, having a family, my paternal grandfather ended his life too. So there's, you know, there's, it's in some of the fabric of our intergenerational genes. And so there's this, and I'm so intrigued by what you have just relayed, which is a mountain of achievement, a mountain of influence, mountain of even as you said, you know, feeling blessed for the opportunities, and you have had that, and the family, and you know, and yet we are at a place, and maybe this is when, you know, to come in with this psychedelic options that are, you know, perhaps going to be more available. But how if people listening having challenges, whether the morning I share that morning experience with you have always, I don't, I know though it does kind of carry into the day for myself and some in our family, but how, looking back at the time you just said 40s and 50s, that there was a harder, maybe a more challenging time period, or just to share how did you balance the reality of what you were experiencing, and perhaps as you even said at the beginning of this, still experience, and then there's, and being able to do in the world. I don't know if you want to share anything maybe about that.
Well, I did write a, you know, 10 years ago, after I'd first tackled it, and reached a level of success that I had set myself, namely having gone public and tackled it, that I still found myself in the parliament when I came out the other end, having actually I didn't find a cure, which I thought was going to happen, but I did find you know, some the things that helped me help manage it, to be honest. So, and also, I think it, I accepted in myself that I'd already, you know, it took me a long time to accept I had depression because, you know, I'm in my 70s, and for half, well, 2/3 of my life, longer probably, it's still around, to be honest, there was a huge stigma, you know, attached to it. And, you know, that I remember as a kid, they'd talk about, you know, Auntie Joan, you know, she had nerves. And you sort of never could, she's got nerves. What's that mean? You know, well, you know, she was as depressed as all get out, actually. But, but everyone, you know, didn't want to talk about it. No one reflect on it because you knew that if you said, I've got a right, you know, a sister or a brother or a parent or yourself was you've got some form of depression, you knew or you felt everyone would be saying, you know, that whole family's a bit, a bit kooky. And so it didn't then, and I saw it as a politician. It mean, so I was nearly 15 years in the parliament. There wouldn't hardly be a month go past when you wouldn't get a representation from some group in the community, usually people affected by, you know, through family member or whatever, diabetes or, you know, cancer or heart problems, you name it, all legitimate, totally legitimate issues. And often they'd have a celebrity with them, they'd have a lot of material, and they'd be there to try and encourage you as the representative of the people to put more pressure on for more money to spend on research in that area.
Yeah.
So, and there'd be every, as I say, probably at least once a month. And that was, you know, that's democracy. And there was absolutely no reflection. They're all doing great things to try and, you know, address an issue, legitimate issues. But the interesting thing was, I think it would have been there. Would have been after about 10 or 11 years, I was in the parliament. I never had one representation from any group about more money for mental health issues. Not one. Hmm. And that's got me thinking, you know, why, you know, because that was an issue, obviously, of any great interest to me. And there was political pressure at that stage starting to build for, and I was supporting others. The Christopher Pyne brought in a program, you know, for the young people to call in at what they call it, the set up centres in local shopping centres and things where young people could headspace.
Yes.
And so, you know, with things like anything like that, I was all, I mean, I was, well, not that I could do a great deal, but anything, I would support in cabinet, any of those sorts of things. And so things were starting to happen, but it was still a stigma. And, you know, that's changed quite, that's been really good, I think, since there's been more supporting people. And, well, there's lots of people now, but I'm still asked, though, when I do speak, which is less often these days, but, you know, if you were 40 again, would you be out saying you've got this problem? And to be honest, I would say I wouldn't.
Okay.
I think I put myself, because I'm I'm a very small employer now, but I'm still in, but I just feel that if I was CEO of a, you know, a significant organisation, well, I'm just thinking a lot would not take you on. Okay, they wouldn't take the risk, and so it's much better that people are talking about it, so people are confronting it more.
Yep.
So that's a real plus, and it's a really critical. But that doesn't mean it necessarily translates into, well, your job ready. You know, that people are going to take you on.
I wonder.
Took a long way to go. Yeah.
Well, and I appreciate you saying that, because I think that is maybe more of a current challenge in terms of being able to be seen as a stable human who has significant responsibilities. Whether it's to an employer, or if you're the head of, you know, organization, or if you're on any level working. And the stats are, you know, and we can, you know, not going into specifics there, but the stats are that there's 1 in 3 or 1 in 5 of humans who are experiencing not just sad mood, but clinically recognized conditions. The reality is we need to be able to communicate about it, but I understand that dilemma, and I think that I wonder for you, and times were different, in the times where it was the most difficult perhaps for you at that time, like, what were your go-tos? Or did you, like, for me personally, like, this is the afternoon and we're videoing this. For me personally, early morning, I'm a yoga meditation teacher, and I don't get up with it at dawn because I take medication, and I, you know, the morning, generally the early morning, is quite difficult for me. So I manage my day practically. I can now, I am 50, in being able to kind of adjust so that I can, just work with my own rhythms. What about for you, though, at the time? You were able to be in those positions, very challenging circumstances, politically, economically, in that regard. What did you do at those times practically, or is there anything that you'd like to share that actually was something that allowed you to help you get through?
Well, I when I sat down and tried to write the book, just my experience, and I realised that subconsciously that all my career choices, that I was chasing adrenaline.
Okay, interesting.
Okay. I had a chance to do a PhD at Harvard at 28, and I got offered the job as an economist at the National Farmers Federation. And I took the job as an economist. And all my friends who were economists said, what the hell is going on? I mean, you've taken a grubby, you've got to take a job with a grubby lobby group when you could have been, you know, in Harvard doing a PhD. At the time, I'm not sure I articulated it even in my own mind properly, but instinctively, at that stage, I'd already had done, been involved in things where I was doing something for 3 months, more or less by myself, you know, a research type thing. And I wasn't in a good place. I'd also been involved in, you know, standing up in Myrtleford in Victoria, you know, on the stage, arguing with tobacco farmers who were all Italian, from Italian extract, right? Very passionate and abusive, and they were fine. But when
challenging, you know, environment,
but and I was in my element. I mean, I was good, and it's, you know, so it was adrenaline that got me going. And even, you know, politics, I'd get a phone call at 6:15 in the morning and my heart would sink, because I just, the last thing I wanted to do was engage. But you know, I'd take the phone because I think there's a problem, answer the call, and then they'd tell me, and I'd say, I'll ring you back in 5, because I hadn't known it. I might want to make a phone call or think about it for a couple of minutes before you start recording. And I just, you know, if the floor would open up, I'd be pleased about it. But so I'd do what I had to do to get ready, and then I'd ring back. And they asked me the question. And then as soon as I started to talk, I could feel this adrenaline, right? And then I could hear my voice, which was normal, right? And whereas, you know, they talked to me sort of offline, I wasn't all that communicative, and my voice wouldn't be strong, and right, I'd be wishing it would go away. But then, so then I'd do the 5 minutes or 1 minute, whatever it was, and afterwards, that day, I would come out of it more quickly.
Right.
Then if I didn't have that experience, or I might have to go and do the TV, you know, there's a lot of morning television there. You'd have to drive into town, we're on 30 acres out of town. And then but as soon as they asked the question, I'd feel the adrenaline. So adrenaline was one of the things that I really pursued. Look, I did bizarre things. I spent 30 years really chasing endorphins, because I thought, I didn't want to admit I had depression, right? So I was looking for positives. You know, I could, at the time, I've got rid of most of them, but I could have made a fortune out of the number of books I had on, you know, how to have a positive attitude to life and all this sort of stuff, right? Actually, when I finally admitted I had depression, and I'm reading some of the depression books, they're saying all the same things that these other books were saying about, you know, about succeeding in life and all that sort of thing. And anyway, but I would I chased endorphins. So I'm driving into town 2 or 3 times. When I look at the sun, some people do that, they sneeze. When you sneeze, you release endorphins. 2 or 3 times I'd stop the car, look at the sun and sneeze, right? Because my first meeting, especially in the 90s when I was running the Liberal Party, there was endless crises. In the morning, we'd have an 8 o'clock hook up with people around, you know, with the leader and whatever. Usually, depending on who it was, but we won't go into that. But more often than not, it was acrimonious, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone had the shits at that hour of the morning, and excuse the language, but it was just ugly. And but often again, having that episode at 8 o'clock, you know, where I've got adrenaline running, yeah. You know, and by the time we'd got off that call, I'd only get the last 15 or 20 minutes, I'd be much better shape than I otherwise would have. I never would try not program meetings in the morning. I mean, up until 9:30, always my PAs would know. I seem to be able to read. I've never watched morning television. I could not handle it. I've never listened to morning radio. Couldn't handle it. I'd turn the radio on at 6 o'clock to see if I've got a problem to deal with. Then I'd turn it off. TV, I could not stand, still can't stand it. I just want to be my own. You know, I swam 1,500 metres every day for 20 years. And now I've got a problem with the shoulder for a while, but I'll get back into the swimming. But I'm now walking for an hour hard. And that's been, exercise has been a really important thing, but not just to get out and do, you know, have a stroll. I've got to really, so it's good for my health as well as my mental health. And, but, you know, I'll go for a walk, hourly walk, and I'll cry. Yep. For the first half.
Mm-hmm.
No good a reason.
Yeah.
And then.
Which is also a letting out, which is good. I mean, which is contain it. You're able, you can.
Well, I don't know what people think. It's early in the morning, so I don't see too many. But I'll just be weeping. And then I'll feel sometimes, a lot of the time, I'll feel, you get this sort of surge. And by the end of it, you know, I'm not weeping and I'm starting to get a bit normal. I don't have a cold, really cold shower, things like that. That certainly, you know, seems to have an impact. Then I just wait. I mean, I'll read what papers I need to and all that sort of thing. But it's...
Mm-hmm. You know, as you are allowing a very basic mechanism, which is crying, yeah. It is, we're not taught that that is the way to be. You just mentioned before... Andrew, you know, you said, you know, until I'm normal. And I just wonder if, you know, this conversation as well related to, you know, also options that perhaps in the health system now because of, you know, legislation change, psychedelics, you know, are being, you know, not just considered, but, you know, approved in in a regulated way. But I wonder if, just that very expression you said, you know, I wait until I'm normal. Mm. And I wonder, you know, it's like if the statistics, and of course, you know, you're in very good company to in this space, I take medicine, which actually sadly makes me not able to cry. I don't know if you've heard that, but it's common because the idea is that it's trying to pharmaceutical medicine, you know, the symptom management. So it's this almost this oxymoron, isn't it? It's, you know, like for you to just be able just, you know, and it comes and, you know, you can tell the emotion. Isn't it interesting? I wonder if the normal, you know, what is, you know, normal? And if the normal really is to be able to have any emotion, whether you're male, female, or, you know, now all the different anacronyms. So trying to be respectful there, but just a rethink of what is, you know, what is normal. And yes, we want to do in the world, what you just said as well, the endorphins, or to kind of be able to get to a part where the energy is moving and you're, you know, moving and shaking, you know, in terms of work or purpose, whatever people are involved in. And, you know, the notion of being able to allow space, which you just gave a really nice example. You often, with the walk, I don't know if you're with someone or on your own, but you're able to, that's authentic. I mean, that is our part of who, you know, an expression of you, not the total expression of you, because look at the examples. If we only took that part of the interview, you know, or, you know, what you have done and accomplished, et cetera, achievement, you know, adrenaline or not, it is extraordinary. And yet there is suffering.
Mm.
And I wonder if you might like to talk, I haven't heard how specifically you got involved with Mind Medicine, but in the you had written your book, kind of from there to being, I guess, maybe exposed to the psychedelic industry. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that, and also just how you're finding doing some work in an area, like you said, when you were in Parliament, you were real in cabinet, you know, like anything would come across from the mental health space, which was different in those times, you identified with. So how did you get involved in, this space, or would you like to share any?
Well, I took a long time to admit it, and then probably by my 50, late 40s, you know, I started to, it only took me 30 years, but started to recognize I had a depressive condition. And I talked to my wife about it, because I was, you know, it was getting more difficult, because I was not, I was doing all the, you know, sneezing and all that stuff.
You had some tools.
Well, they were pretty amateurish tools, but I was doing as much exercise and stuff as I suppose that was the main one that had any sort of lasting impact. But I was not, you know, on any pills or anything at that stage. And I talked to my wife, and, you know, we sort of, well, we didn't know what to do at that stage. You know, even, well, I did get to a point where she said, you should talk to your doctor about it. So I go to the doctor, and the doctor, just, you know, at the end of whatever I wanted to say, oh, by the way, there's a little matter. And he said, oh, look, I don't deal with that. So I told him briefly what it was. He said, I don't deal with that. And he gave me a card. And it's in the suburbs, you know, I'm down the suburbs in Melbourne. And he gave me a card, and he said, there's a woman, I get people to go and see her. Right? So she was a psychologist. So I turn up a couple of weeks later. I've already made an appointment, and turn up, and anyway, she's just on normal suburban home, and we're going in the front room, and there's a couch. Well, that was a bad start. She said, you lie down on the couch, you know. So, then, you know, after a couple of minutes, she said, right, now tell me, just give me some background. Fair enough. So I started, I don't know, been going, honestly, about 3 or 4 minutes trying to just, you know, repeat when it started and what it was. And I hardly got anywhere into it, to be honest. And she leaned across and said, sort of whispering, you know, were you loved by your mother and your father? I'm sitting there. No, I was lying there. You know, and I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. What the hell am I doing here? You know. And I stood up. I said, I owe you $125. Here it is. I had a checkbook at those days. I'm not comfortable with this. And have a good day. And left, right? And I went home, and did what he usually did, you snap out of it. This is mind over matter. You make a fool of yourself. And fancy, you know, being stuck in this situation where you took him. I mean, here's something. I had a very happy childhood, by the way. So, and in fact, when I did tell my mother, you know, years later when I was going to say some things publicly, she said, of all nine, I was the happiest. And I had a problem when I was about 12, 2 years at school, where I lived in fear for 2 years with the teachers. And we shifted from the farm to the city, and things in my mind just didn't work out. But it was, and she did say, my mother said, you know, you're the happiest. But she said, in your, we noticed in your teenage years, you went quiet in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And they just thought, you know, you have nine kids, they're all different. You know, what she thought, they just thought hormones or something. Because by when I got back from school in the day, I'd be normal. So, but I was, you know, compared with what I had been as a child, they said I was very quiet in the mornings. And I can remember walking to the station and to catch the train, you know, 7:45 or something in the mornings, and to go off to school. And I'd be seeing all these old fellows in their dressing gowns walking to the down to the bottle, you know, their post box. You know, usually good milk was usually delivered in a bottle and often at their gate at those days. And they'd be picking up the milk and getting the paper. And I'd just be wishing that I was that old, that life, I'd gone through life, I had no more responsibilities, and I was their age. So here I am at, you know, 14 and 15, et cetera, thinking that it was wishing that I'd be, you know, at the end of my life. And but then, you know, I'd see the Santa Maria girls on the train, and things started to change for me every day. So, you know, it was a couple of hours to start with, and then as I went on through life, it got a bit longer and a bit longer. When I finally did challenge it, I still hadn't told anyone, but I got approached by a number of colleagues, including Peter Costello, for the matter, who was still in the parliament but had advised that he was leaving, and we'd lost the earlier election a couple of years before, and a year and a half before, and they wanted me to, Malcolm Turnbull was the leader at the time, so they wanted me to challenge him for the leadership, which I was really keen to do. That's, for me, the sad part about all this. In many respects, you know, a lot of what I had done, I thought I'd done such an, had a, such an eclectic background in terms of issues and policies and whatever, that I thought, increasingly thought I was well placed to handle a lot of, lots of issues. And
you had been, you had handled a lot of issues.
I had, yes. Yeah. And so it was, but it also brought to mind, you know, I'd also been close enough to it all, very close, in fact, when I was running the party in particular, to the campaigns and, you know, a crisis a minute in a campaign which I designed for that, so that people can see what you're like under pressure, I think. But crises, endless crises, that's politics. And I was, you know, I was always... It was a good thing for me, the crises, to be honest. And the people would say, how did you ever run the campaigns? And I said, well, I have an adrenaline, full of adrenaline for 33 days. I look forward to the campaigns. Yeah. You know, I was in a great space in the campaigns because I'd have adrenaline. I always got ill after the campaigns because, you know, you have adrenaline in your system for 30 or 40 days. But So I got approached, and but it brought I knew that the job was, 24/7, and also I knew once you say yes, it does become this sort of bubble, a movement. I mean, you sort of lose control. I mean, the people around you who are trying to make it happen. I mean, it's the way it is. It's just the system, and so I really had to be. You can't sort of half get into it and then, then back out of it. So I said, look, I'm interested, but I'll just think about it. Now, I was definitely interested and I didn't have to think about it. Well, the thing I had to think about was what the hell am I going to do with this problem in the mornings? Because even at that stage, it was getting to be sort of 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. And some days even something might happen at night, and it would affect me for a little while, but not persistently. Anyway, and that's when I, notwithstanding the thing that happened 6 months before, when I went to the local psychologist, I rang Jeff Kennett, who was heading Beyond Blue and did an unbelievable job there, I think. And he was down in Tasmania with the football team. And he said, he'll be free a bit later. He'll ring me back. And I told him what was happening. I told him, briefly everything that was happening. And he said, look, I'm no expert on this, but I'll come back to you. Well, by the way, that was Saturday. By Wednesday morning, I'm sitting up with a psychiatrist who was one of Australia's best. And that was fascinating because, I kid you not, we started the conversation. He said, tell me about it. And I started, and after about 5 minutes or less, he said, oh, just let me stop for a second. I thought, oh, this is not again. He said, I want to say, he said, I know what it is. It's fixable, but you'll have to have patience and there could be some side effects. Now go on with this story. So that was quite a different intervention than the earlier one. In fact, all I heard was, we can fix this. That's all I heard. And so we had that session. I came out of that session thinking, that's fantastic. I take a pill, 3 weeks' time, it's worked its magic, and then I can say to them all, I'm ready to go. Well, the trouble is that 3 weeks was, I'd have to say, and it still is, the worst 3 weeks of my life, right? Because it gave me a thing called Lexapro, which millions of people have. I mean, it's pretty common. But it just showed you, it taught me something for later on, and that is that they don't know what happens to any of the drugs. It's all a hit and miss, total hit and miss. And it's, luck of the draw, and you just keep going. But it made me a lot more depressed. In fact, it made me suicidal. My wife was sort of 20 on 24/7 watch because I got so depressed. And it did teach me what it's like for those people who've got depression 24/7. And I'm thinking, I don't know how they. I mean, there's plenty out there in that case, and I don't know how they do it. Frankly, I mean, in awe of people in that situation who keep going, because it was just horrible. And so I go back and I see him and I tell him it's what's happened, and I said, what do we do now? And he said, we'll double the dose. And I said, well, I still get side effects. He said, possibly. And so he doubled the dose. Within 5 days, I could not handle it any longer. I'm sitting in my office and I spent hours and hours and hours looking at the wall.
Yeah.
And decided, I thought my career was over in politics, but I had to make a choice between making a fool of myself by saying yes when I wasn't well enough, or finding out what the hell was wrong with me and could I do something about it, and maybe continue to make a contribution one way or another.
Yeah. Well, that is Yeah, thank you for being so honest with that. So along that pathway, then how did you get involved, or what are, you know, in terms of hearing about the psychedelic space? I take it that wasn't your past, in terms of, it hadn't been part of your past, this use of psychedelics. So how did you segue from that, realizing you didn't need, or that the medicine wasn't going to be helpful for you personally, to then being in a position to at least explore the potential of psychedelics in the mental health system?
Well, I did. It took 6 months of trial and error, but I did find something that gave me some relief, right? But every one of them, side effects, right? It gave me some relief, is the best thing. Rather, I didn't beat it, but it gave me a better capacity to manage it. And I think this is what, I'd be, after I got to that point, I'd say to people, you can beat it. Well, I don't think with the current drugs you can, frankly. I mean, you can keep doing trial and error, and then you might find something which gives you, like you mentioned, you're taking drugs. I take 7 pills a day. I'm sick of taking 7 pills a day. I don't know what the hell it's doing to me otherwise. One of them is lithium. I know when I took 2 lithium rather than 1 lithium, which was prescribed, I was nearly running into cars it influenced my balance so much. I could never tell going over the Harbour Bridge where there's 7 lanes with cars going 70K, all up close to one another, very tight. I lost any sense of how close I was to the car on the left.
Okay.
So those sorts of, and I cut out, once I took out 1 lithium, I'm still on the other one, and who knows what's going on. But I have got a mix which is, which is, it does help me, but it doesn't fix it. It's a management tool. And I suppose from the time we were talking about when I confronted it and it took six months of trial and error before we found something that, was sort of workable. And then for nearly 10 years, the rest of my, it wasn't there for another 10, it did the job well enough. And then I got into the, once you're doing 200 nights overseas each year, you're on the move, you got adrenaline, I was in my element, and so many things happening. There'd be some mornings still when I would be, but I better come out of it, apply the usual things, but what I'd found is something would work for 5 years and then it wouldn't, and I'd go and see the psychiatrist and say, well, it's not working, and what's that, why? And he says, we don't know, right? And we'll just try something else. And so then I'm back on this merry-go-round trying things, but the trouble was sometimes they'd work pretty well, and but you get side effects. Like, I wasn't particularly interested in going without sex for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, Or, you get tired or you get this or that. And everything's associated, with it to some greater or lesser extent. It's where the balance is going to suit you, And that's when, so I got approached, I'd left politics. And I was back in Sydney. They approached me, Mind Medicine Australia, the psychedelics organisation, approached me to see if I'd go on the executive.
Okay.
And it was really, to be honest, I knew what a psychedelic was, but not much more. You know, you get over a trip or something. That's drugs have not been a part of my life, and I read up about it and thought, at the very least, it's I can't believe that the success they were having in the '50s and sixties was not sufficient to warrant, you know, at least researching it properly. You know, I talked to some friends, a couple who'd been through psychiatry in the '80s and nineties. They never had it mentioned to them. It wasn't mentioned. They did a whole degree on psychiatry. And here's in the '50s and sixties, here's this thing called psychedelics, which was seen as the new frontier, right? 40,000 papers had been written on it in that period. And then it got, you know, banned for political purposes by Richard Nixon. Nothing to do with mental health. It was all to do with getting the head of the peace movement into jail. And he was very effective with it. But because the head of the free world had banned it, every other one in the West banned it, absolutely. And it's not even addictive, for God's sake, you know. And, you know, I've been very much against us advocating its recreational use, and I still am, because I think whilst it's not addictive, recreational use will in many cases be associated with situations where drugs that are addictive, there'll be people using them, right? And I don't think we should create that circumstance. And certainly I felt the priority, it's far better to, you know, maintain that restriction on its availability and get the benefit from the medical treatment of psychedelics. So it didn't take long for me to get enthusiastic about it, I can tell you, and at least as an option. And partly just I try and understand. It was more the politics that people who haven't got this bloody problem were making decisions about, you know, my circumstance and thousands of others to ban this because politically it's difficult to convince a whole lot of people who've got kids that can be managed in a way for medicinal purposes. They didn't, and that's been the problem. It's just been politicians, particularly at a state level, who've got charge of this thing, and they all try to block it still. And it's not just the politicians, it's the bureaucrats at the state level. As you know, it was the TGA who approved against the advice of the committee of state people. We would still be sitting here, you know, arguing about, not arguing, but discussing the merit of, you know, I keep saying to them, how many other, you tell me one drug, you tell me one drug that's had more than 160 trials. No one can ever tell me one drug that's had that. And that's what these psychedelics have had. And you look at the results, you show me one drug that's, you know, we've had everything available. There's cases of people having up to 100 ECTs, up to 100. Can you imagine that? Someone sticking, you know, electricity into your brain, and still after 100, it's not, nothing's happening, and they think they've tried everything. For God's sake, you know, I get so cross about this. At least to have this thing as an option, people still got the choice whether they use it or not. No one's being forced to use it, and yet, you know, The attempts to stop and block this thing by the major parts of the profession, like the College of Psychiatry, you know, you wonder what agenda's going on here.
Yeah. Well, you have, you know, you have such, obviously you've had the depth of personal experience, but and also the, you know, the mental health system itself. The fact that now at least we're having this conversation, as you say, and not having to, you know, because legislation has occurred from it being a Schedule 9 to a Schedule 8, a prohibited substance, Schedule 8 now for MDMA and psilocybin, the opportunity of being able to utilize the these medicines for people on the pointy end. Yes, you know, as an example, you know, my sister lived in America. It wasn't approved yet in, you know, legally. And she did not feel, she was very, you know, conservative. And so it wasn't for her, even though we had looked at the evidence, she didn't see it as an option, but she also was not accessible at that time. She was very sick, but as I had mentioned, on 12 different medicines, and still not working. So the potential worldwide, you know, for the use of these drugs, and Australia being you know, first really to be able to offer. What are your thoughts now around the system? So decisions have been made in terms of this FDA and how the Human Research and Ethics Committees, you know, the process that's going to be for this to work. What are your thoughts on, you know, you mentioned the state issues. What do you think, with your experience also in politics and system structure, is going to kind of, what do you predict is going to happen? Or what do you think needs to be shifted in either, you know, we haven't even touched on it, but also even the diagnostic manual, you know, the diagnostic manuals that we have now, which give us the condition that people have based on symptoms. I mean, we both talked about that, our personal histories there. Yeah, just your comments on the health system, how this is going to roll out, and what your, yeah, what your kind of, yeah, what your experience tells you.
Well, you know, once the euphoria died down, we then got told there had to be regulations prepared by each state. So I sought a meeting with the new minister for mental health in New South Wales, and just to brief her on what's happening and all of it. She was a great meeting. She's very enthusiastic, and said she was very keen for New South Wales to lead Australia in the adoption, right? Within about, we had the senior people from the department in that meeting who didn't say anything much, except what was said, oh, there still needs to be some trials. And I said, well, there's been none in Australia, and we look forward to the trials that you do implement, but there's been hundreds elsewhere. Surely that must have a bearing, you know, on decisions we make here, given that it's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel, all of with a health system comparable to ours, and certainly a research system comparable to ours. All the material's been available publicly, and the fact that, you know, it hasn't been initiated here, it shouldn't be any impediment to moving on it. But they made this point about, you know, we have to do more trials. And that's when I said, please tell me of one drug that's available today for any purpose, which has had more than 160 trials. And of course, there was no answer to it because there hasn't been, right? And anyway, we wait 3 or 4 weeks later, out come the New South Wales regulations. You can't, notwithstanding the fact that out of 160 trials, about three of them have required overnight stays, and it made absolutely no difference to the outcome. The first requirement is this thing couldn't be done unless it was done in a hospital. And an overnight stay, there's limited beds, it's over possibly 2,000 or more a night. So after three treatments, that's, you know, that's 6,000 or 7,000 before you even talk about the people, the therapists are going to have to be there, and all of the other things. This is for the, you know, seriously wealthy. You know, I mean, and they've probably all gone to Costa Rica anyway years ago, you know, for treatments. You know, honestly, so I sought a meeting with the, and I got a meeting with the senior bureaucrats, and they said, well, you know, we didn't support it. I said, well, it's a decision by the TGA. So they said, oh, well, we gave advice to the TGA, don't do it. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, we don't know enough about it. And that's when I said, again, I asked you this last time, but you have not, you didn't give me an answer then. You haven't, have you got an answer now about the number of trials and the success rate and what's happening with MDMA? I said, you know, the best rate of success, if you want to talk about remission, we would be lucky to get 4 or 5% of people with post-traumatic stress disorder into a position of remission with every possible technique that's available. And there's so much work has gone on by so many organisations to deal with those very poor unfortunates, especially the military, but anyone who's at the, you know, front-end person, with ambulances and all the rest of it. And so I said, how can you stand in the way of another option for these people? I know we've got to find out who's the right people to get this, and you know, there could be consequences down the track. And they listed 3 or 4 other things that were supposed to be, you know, God's gift to medical health years ago, which didn't succeed. And I said, well, you know, none of those had this sort of level of trial over 15 years. That's what the trials have been going for. But anyway, and they were, you know, and I said, by the way, you know, no one can afford it. It's ridiculous. Why is the first time we've ever heard of having people in hospital in years of debate has been your regulations? Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Victoria, I understand, which I haven't studied, but understand certainly not doing that. I think I thought what the provisions that they brought out were hugely well, bureaucratic, but happy to have it if it's going to prove to people that they weren't prohibitive, right? And the ethics committee and all these things, though it's finally, people are getting approval in Victoria, and then they go to the department, they go to the TGA to get a final approval, and the ethics committee looks at the protocols and the patient and the protocols and the psychiatrist, and supposedly assesses all the things that, and then it goes on the TGA and they do it all again. So it does seem, but and it's taking much longer than you would anticipate. So we can live with that. At least at the other end, there'll be people. But I'm telling you, at $2,000 a night or more, with hospitals that haven't got room for them anyway, with psychiatrists, we've got some outstanding psychiatrists who run clinics, but clinics are not allowed because they can't stay overnight. But the clinics, they spend their days and night, and a day, they spend their days working within that clinic with people who've got mental health. I mean, you know, there's no, you said, what's going to happen? Well, I'm telling you, it's, there's every attempt to frustrate it. That's what's going to happen. And unless we keep the pressure on, right? So as soon as we see a couple of cases come through and where we start to see some results, a facility has been set up at ANU, which takes account of every possible treatment around the country. Independent, it's an outstanding initiative. Because it, you know, people aren't just selected and doing it within a sort of confined trial. It'll be people in their own environment. right? So you have all these people with different environments who will be dealt with individually, so we'll have some really solid data, and we have to live with whatever that comes up with, right? But to me, that's if you truly, you know, if you want real science, that's what you do. I don't know. They keep telling me where they need more trials, and I say, well, what about this ANU thing? That gives to me that is real trials, because it's individuals in their own circumstance in a different. Everyone will be a different environment. How good is that? Is that not a huge trial? Can't you facilitate lots of people to do it? And then, because all that data will go in and we'll find it. No, no, we need trials. Oh, damn it. You know, it's.
Do you think that's money grab, Andrew?
What's that? Sorry.
Do you think that's a money grab? I mean, is obviously state and federal in Australia, for those people who aren't. You know, from Australia, you know, the state and federal governments have, you know, notoriously had clashes. And some, you know, even the COAG, you know, Council of Australian Governments, where state and federal issues get vetted and hopefully we, you know, there's progress. Is New South Wales any different at this time, or?
Well, I understand there's a couple of other states that have got a requirement for going to hospitals.
Okay.
So there's been, they said to me they conferred with other states. Well, they might have, and they obviously did, because, but there's been opposition, strong opposition from most of the states for most of the time, to be honest. It was a very courageous decision, I think, by the TGA. But there's such a – there's no downside. The good's in the sake, I mean, another option.
Yeah.
And if people choose to take that option, you know, they're driving them underground now. And as you say, you know, your sister took a judgment that I'd taken. I didn't want to – I don't know who's doing these things on the grey market, what they're like, you know. And in my case, I didn't want to create a problem either with when I'm trying to advocate for its use, you know. But there's, and I don't even know how big that market is or whatever, but it shouldn't have to be, it shouldn't exist, that market, you know, because, again, if it was, it just seems that there's so little downside for anybody. You know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But the trials, you know, by some of the most prominent people associated with long-form drug treatments and all that, of all types, have been at the forefront of this stuff for such a long time overseas. And you know, I've met quite a few of them there. They are... people of great consequence, you know, and sensible people. It's so deeply frustrating. But look, we are a lot further than we might have been. If we only have one state that's sensible, that's enough. That's a wedge. We can find out from that state. You know, there's several million people there. Let's really encourage people who've got a problem to see a good psychiatrist, get that person ratified by 42 committees. No, get that person ratified and get on with it. And, you know, we can then use that to convince the others whose justification I cannot accept for a second, but they're entitled to take that position.
Do you think that, just the last thing, because I know we'll have to close soon, but I could speak to you all day. You know how in Australia, at least, you know, the Council of Australian Governments, I'm not sure if that still occurs, but do you think that there is kind of not just bipartisan, but in terms of state and federal coordination. I don't, you probably would have maybe been in the 90s when I was doing my doctorate long ago, but the coordinated care trials were looking at, you know, between 1996 and 1999, COAG initiated these, you know, Council of Australian Government coordinated care trials, of which mental health, you know, people with mental health conditions, there were some trials that had people who, you know, had mental affliction. And yeah, do you see that kind of model? Or do you think that, because I wanted you to just touch on equity for a moment, just before, I know it's a big issue itself, and I could talk to you maybe again another time, but the equity side of, from the, you know, who is going to fund it? What are your thoughts in that space? From a politician background in politics, et cetera, or is that going down? You know, what other health, what other funding mechanisms do we have, like architecturally or engineering wise, that we can go with? Or do you think there's promise in the political system?
Look, it's early, too early, I think. My sense, I mean, the MMA are looking at, you know, and encouraging the states in particular, but all forms of government, but also looking at from a private donation point of view, how we might subsidise but in the early stages, it is going to be expensive. This is the point of getting through this early stuff, you know, so that if we start to get numbers and acceptance, then the price will come down. And even we've certainly acted significantly on the cost of the substance itself. And it's, you know, I think that the team at MMA have done a great job negotiating the reduction of that. So that's not a big part of it, to be honest. You know, it is. If you had to go to hospital versus, it, you know, just doing it in a clinic, I mean, that's a huge difference. And all of a sudden, you're going to be cut off, you're going to reduce by hundreds of percent the cost of the thing. So let's deal with some of those issues to start with. Then if there's significant, you know, it's going to cost, nevertheless, quite a lot. But I think if we start to see results, then you've got the political imperative. Well, this has got to be available to the whole community, right? Well, some people can't afford it. Well, how do we make it affordable for everybody, right? So we have got such a crisis that I think if we do land on something which is materially more effective than what has been the case, if you just took post-traumatic stress disorder, I mean, they're getting 60 to 80% remission. I was talking about 4 to 5% in Australia now. In the trials, and they've been in the US, and they've now gone through all the trials. They just need a decision now. But that's the level. Can you imagine 60 to 80% remission? And these people, all of the people in those trials, I think the minimum had been 18 years with it. In other words, these are long-term cases. And we all know about people who, you know, who have got that problem. And it's just, it's now, depression, probably just as many or more cases, but I'm just saying, you know, that evidence, it's there. So, look, I've got to stop being too down. I think we should be celebrating the fact we've got a decision. We are the first in the Western world to get it. Let's keep that same pressure that we got to get that decision. Let's maintain that pressure and that resolve and start to see results in Australia. And the results then will lead to the equity issues, I think, being satisfactorily dealt with. We've got such a big problem, they'll have to.
Well, I think that the opportunity as well with the treatment-resistant depression, and, you know, you've given your example, you know, personal example, and I've said this before, but a psychiatrist that I saw for a long time would say that some of the drugs have a poop out effect. That's how she classified it. When literally after, you know, 5 or 6 years, there would be an unanswerable of why they necessarily, you know, stop working, so to speak. And so people who have taken, you know, for me, since I was 18, being on medication to now I'm 50, you know, there is a lot of, and I've had ECT, you know, bilateral, not 100, but I know the cases that you're talking about, but 9 bilateral. And even to have a different option, you know, which is why I would, you know, I've had my own personal sister's history, but, you know, my own, you know, in looking at, or even yourself, I don't know where you stand in terms of whether you consider it yourself, but open to penetrating where, I suppose, medical, the pharmaceutical drugs and the many different things I do as well, you know, for a day, in a day, to be able to survive. And many days it is that way, but also thrive. And these conversations, you know, I really very deeply thank you for having this conversation, because not only are you in an influential position, whether it be Mind Medicine Australia or elsewhere, but that you are living history of being able to at least open our minds, and perhaps it's the heart as well, to ways in which we can live more toward the thriving than simply daily survival. And I suppose the encounters, as you said, when you would go running or walking, you know, really reach me deeply, I think, for listeners as well. Because there's a loneliness in that space. And I think people who, you know, as humans, we do suffer. That's part of being human.
Mm.
But I, you know, I guess the opening to the potential of this in the space. So I don't know if you either have anything else that you'd like to share or around, you know, considering it. Would you consider it yourself?
Oh, of course. Yeah, once it's available. Yeah. That's what, without a doubt. And we'll see. There is one thing. There's a young woman wrote to me years ago after I'd gone public, and I did quite a few interviews like this around the country because it seemed to help. And but it really has been, I keep it in my wallet, and it's been a real spur to me when I've needed it to I think about this young woman. I mean, I did write back to her, and that's it. I haven't had any contact since, nor did I seek it, but I just wanted to share that if I could, because I think it
works. Please do.
Yeah, and it's, hey, Andrew, or whichever of his minions read this, as a minister at the time, is he? I heard your interview on ABC today regarding your experience with depression. I've had depression for years, and when I heard you speak this morning, it really made me realise yet again that depression is not a weakness, but a legitimate issue. As I'm still a student in high school, I suppose I'm under rather a lot of pressure to do well, though in comparison to pressure placed upon you as a federal politician, it probably seems like nothing. Lately, I've been feeling that I'm not going to do anything in life because I tend to have weeks or months in which I feel rather like you described in the interview, staring at the wall for 2 hours rather than answering calls and emails. But you showed me that it's not a case of my being lazy or, well, stupid. If successful men such as yourself have felt this way, then maybe there's hope for a 16-year-old schoolgirl. I do feel rather an idiot for saying all of this, but you have actually made me feel like pursuing my goal of studying law for the first time in months. Thank you, Claire.
Oh,
it's a nice note to finish on, I think.
It is a beautiful note to finish on, and thank you for the work that you do, the tireless work that you've given this country on so many levels, depth and breadth, and the fact of taking the time to on this very important area of potential for humanity. And that, you know, as I, you know, thank you for answering, even in your personal, on the personal level of being open to less suffering. You know, in Mind Medicine Australia, you know, it talks about preventing suicide and suffering. I think that the work that you have done and your openness and your candidness will penetrate very deeply with anyone listening, but also people who are trying to just balance in a, you know, morning, let alone a day, let alone, you know, a week, month, etc. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Deborah, and thank you for what you're doing to contribute to the same issue. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And we'll be in touch. No doubt it's a continued conversation.
Okay. Thank you.